You could be right and I could be wrong. We could just fight and we could be strong. You could be right and I could be wrong. We could just fight and we could.
This is Bridge the Gap with Mark and Dave, the program that seeks for the truth no matter where it is found. I'm Mark.
And I'm David.
Today we're planning on talking about the pearl.
What is the pearl in a nutshell?
So the pearl is something that we've alluded to in previous podcasts. It actually comes from the Qumran scrolls. The reason I like the pearl so much, and the first time I read the pearl was way back in 1990s sometime. We're talking 25 years ago when I came across it. And it just shouted out to me that this is cool and I could learn something from this. And here I am 25, 30 years older. And I'm still thinking a lot about what the pearl's symbolism, what truths are in it, what it really means. And I want to share it with the listeners so that they can draw their own conclusions about the truthfulness or lack of truthfulness there is in this. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up.
One of the reasons it's interesting to me because it's our journey.
Well, I just want to point out that this does not come from Joseph Smith. It was translated from Syriac by at least five different scholars.
And what's Syriac?
That's the language of ancient Syria. The original document was found in 1906 by Rendell Harris. Alfred Adam, a Catholic scholar who lived in Jerusalem, dates it between 50 AD and 70 AD. That means it could have been written within 25 years of the crucifixion. So Walter Crum, who is the great authority on Coptic documents, places it right there in the first century. You can't get an older original Christian document than this.
That's cool.
I'm going to start reading this translation with added commentary from Hugh Nibley. It starts out, "In my first primeval childhood." So he's talking about a place where he was in heaven before he came here. It goes on to say, "I was nurtured in the royal house of my father with loving care in the midst of an abundance and glory. My parents sent me forth from our home in the east, the source of light supplied with all necessities. My parents made a packet for me from our rich storehouse. It was sizable, but light enough for me to carry. I came from the house on high as a great treasure, bringing with me precious stones from India and Kushan and gold and silver, and they girt me with a diamond. They removed from me the garment of light which they made for me above." What do you think the garment of light might be resembling?
I don't know.
From Hugh Nibley's interpretation of it, the idea is that when you lived in heaven, you had a heavenly garment, and when you left, it was put aside carefully, folded up and put under the Father's throne to be kept there until you can come back, if you were worthy to receive it again. So a good deal is said about this in the Syriac stuff, according to Hugh Nibley. For example, about the great tragedy of sinning in this life because you lose all that you invested. What you have up there represents long terms of investment and work to achieve such a state. You left it all there on reserve, on deposit, the crown and the garment carefully folded and deposited in the throne, some say, in a special chest for you to resume when you return. If you can't take it back, you have lost all that you worked for before, which makes this earthly trial a key experience, a terrifying sort of thing if we miss it. You can miss it, and it's so important not to. That's Hugh Nibley's explanation of the white garment from his own research.
Yeah, the whole idea of like the test, this being a test, I never liked that way of putting it. But I do believe that it's kind of like what you always tell me. It's more of just remembering, knowing who we really are and not letting Satan deceive us. You know, like that to me is the test in a nutshell. Like, it's not like Heavenly Father's like, okay, I'm going to test you necessarily. It's more of like, okay, I trust you. Like, do your thing. Remember who you are. I believe in you, you know? Not like, okay, I'm going to test my children and see who passes.
Sure, know? Yeah. I get what you're saying about that because I don't really think that God is testing us. being an omnipotent, all-knowing being, he already knows.
Right.
He doesn't have to test us about anything. If anything, what's being
tested... He's giving us an opportunity.
To discover for ourselves right. what he already knows about us. Mm-hmm. That is the only version of a test that we're really experiencing here. We're discovering what he already knows about who we are. So yeah, I agree in that sense. He never tests anyone. Why would you test somebody when you already know the outcome?
Yeah.
You don't need to. It's not necessary.
Totally.
He's not proving us. He's giving us an opportunity to prove to ourselves who he already knows we are.
See, yeah, to me that just makes so much more sense when it's put that way. And growing up in the church, you hear all the time, okay, like, you know, get tested in this life, you know.
Yeah.
But, and yeah, anyways. But in terms of the pearl, yeah, to me it just, it's a great way to just explain a lot of stuff in a little story.
We have to pick out what we think is true versus what we think might be erroneous. And the listener gets to decide for themselves what they feel about this. This is simply a translation of an ancient text, and we're reading the story. So continuing on the translation, they removed from me the garment of light which they had made for me, and my purple robe made exactly to fit me, and it would fit no one else. Purple represents the color of nobility. It's a royal robe that's being taken off. So it's an indication that this person is stepping down from a position of royalty. Hugh Nibley says that the robe had certain marks on it. Not sure where he came up with that. Maybe he was reading other Syriac texts and understands some of those things that I'm just going to take it for face value. That's what he knows. So now continuing on with the translation, they made a covenant with me and wrote it in my heart, lest I go astray. So you have a covenant with your parents above in this test, as Hugh Nibley is calling it. He was instructed to go down to Egypt and bring back the pearl. It's in the sea, guarded or surrounded by a fire of poisonous snorting serpent, the dragon. This was the dragon or the serpent of the Garden of Eden guarding this thing. But he has to get it away from him. He has to outwit the dragon and get the pearl in the story. That's Hugh Nibley's commentary. Now, returning back to the translation. Returning to the pearl, he may resume his garment of light and his outer priestly mantle and become heir to our kingdom along with our second one. Hugh Nibley says the second one is the second heir to the throne. He will become an heir along with the son, not the second born. That is the firstborn, Christ, the elder brother. And Hugh Nibley goes on to talk about, there the guides leave him on his own, and he goes on towards Egypt. As in the book of Tobit here, Egypt means the spiritual Sodom. In Egypt, he immediately looks up the serpent who has the pearl. The serpent is staying at an inn. So he goes in to the inn and checks in to keep an eye out on the serpent and catch him while he is still asleep. This is a bad idea because it's dangerous to get, as we would call it, in bed with the enemy. The enemy lulls him to sleep and distracts him from his mission. During his sojourn, he meets a young nobleman from his own country who was born in the same covenant and with whom he shares full confidence. The nobleman warns him against the temptations and defilements of Egypt. He says, "You're in dangerous country. I can help you get out of here." The nobleman reminds him of the letter his parents wrote in his heart, and this was what the letter said. "Awake and arise from thy sleep. Heed this letter. Remember that you are the son of the king, and take a good look at your present master, the dragon. Remember your mission to fetch the pearl. Remember the garment and the robe that are awaiting you so you can put them on again when your name is called out from the book of those who were valiant, and you will become the heir to our kingdom along with your brother, the successor to our throne." Then the king with his right hand sealed the letter against the evil children of Babylon and the rebellious spirits of Sarbug, lest they open and read it, or destroy it. Hugh Nibley says that the sealing is very important in the early Christian writings. So from this point on, he does an about face and everything reverses. He remembers the pearl and he has to get it. So he sets about lulling the serpent to sleep, invoking over it the name of the Father. He does it by prayer. Having seized the pearl, he does an about face, wholly drawn to one direction towards the Father's house, having at his point reached the uttermost depths. First, he sheds his filthy garments for cleaner ones. Then he leaves them behind in the world where they belong. He sets his course towards the light of our home in the east. The letter that woke him also leads the way, both as a guiding voice and as a guiding light. Encouraged the traveler by its guiding voice and instructions about which fork of the road to follow, etc., and by drawing him on with love, he successfully passes through Sarbug and left Babylon on his left. And so he reached Meishan, the port of the merchants, where you can cross the division line on the shore of the sea. There his garment and his outer robe were waiting for him. The pearl continues, "At the doors of the palace, which was from the beginning, I mingled among them." So it's a classic tale. A king's son has come down to earth to find a pearl, which he is to return to its heavenly depository. Here below, he becomes defiled with the things of the world until a letter from heaven signed by all the great and mighty ones recalls to him his true heritage and his purpose in coming to the earth, whereupon he casts off his earthly garments and with the pearl returns to the waiting arms of his loved ones in the royal courts on high. Anyway.
That's longer than what you sent me.
Is it?
Because you sent me about, it seems like a third of that.
Anyways.
So I have a question. So the serpent is holding the pearl. The serpent is holding our integrity. And we need to like get it from him. Or is that just the battle here?
Yeah, it's more about the battle here. The serpent is guarding, trying to keep from us, take away our integrity. So this is one person's interpretation of the value of the pearl. It says, just reading from an article that was written about it. Here is one interpretation of the general meaning of the allegory of the pearl, as introduced in Edgar Hennick's New Testament Apocrypha. This story is described as a fabulous narrative of a Gnostic Redeemer myth in which, to be sure, nothing points to Christian origin. What is truth? What is your truth? What is the truth? Do you find any Christian value in this story?
Yeah, Christian value and just value in general. To me, I know a lot of people that aren't Christian that I think would hear that story and see value in it.
I agree with you. I think it's just another example of the confusion that's out there as to when we're on our journey and seeking truth, what is true to one person may not be true to another person. And we would respect that. I personally find great value in this and I find that it falls very closely to things that I've been taught. You know, trying to figure out what my purpose here is in this life. I think it's a cool story.
Well, I just think it's interesting, the integrity part, the pearl being the integrity, our integrity. But then that letter written in our hearts.
Mm-hmm. What do you think that represents to you?
What I knew coming down here, like before the veil, what I knew, mm-hmm. Who I am.
To me, it's what I already learned before the foundations of this world. That I am supposed to remember in this life. After I was born into this mortal body, it's what was written into my heart for me to remember. When this traveler came into the new land and new country, he was very quickly lulled to sleep by the dragon. To me, that represents distraction. So easy to get distracted by the treasures and the fancy and the fun of this world. For some, I guess it's not so fun, but for others, it's extremely fun. And it's very easy to get distracted. And it definitely worked for him. He was lulled to sleep, forgot who he was, what his mission was in coming to this world, and almost didn't remember. But what changed? What was it that changed his outcome so that he remembered in the story?
Remind me.
It was another nobleman from his same country.
That's really
another
interesting.
Another covenant maker. See, he had made covenants before coming down into this country, and he met another nobleman who also made covenants, who reminded him of the letter written in his heart that had been sealed. When he finally did open it and read it, what did the traveler do? He did an about face.
Did the opposite.
Wholeheartedly turned back to his parents in their heavenly home and didn't ever look back. You know, when Lot's wife turned back and turned into a pillar of salt. It's almost reminiscent of that story. He didn't look back.
Isn't it? It's not looking back. It's looking back with longing. That's bad.
Explain that. Yeah. Desiring to go back.
Right. Which is so different than looking back. Like, for instance, in my life, I know I'm going to have to look back a lot to draw upon things, experiences, memories in order to help those that are going through what I went through. But looking back with longing, that's a whole different ballgame, you know.
I think that's a very valid and good point to bring up. How might you apply this story to your own journey in other ways besides not looking back with longing?
He remembered because of the other nobleman. I think that's huge. It's not just he remembered because he was pondering or just because, you know, the whole idea of asking for help, like getting help, reaching out, connecting with others that are on that journey and helping each other. I think that's God's way of helping us quite often, right? The reason I went on a mission, I think, was pretty much this one kid that I grew up with. He was in my ward and he was always just like, who's going on a mission? And he'd raise his hand. And so he'd like, come on, guys. And like, I'd raise my hand. And like his example from such a young age was huge for me. Like it just, because my dad didn't serve a mission and he's a convert and everything. And so it's just interesting how there's different people on our paths that have been on my path that have been huge with helping me remember or helping me take steps so that I have experiences to help me remember and all that stuff.
Thank you. I find that this garment being left behind is very integral to the story. Does that bear any meaning for you?
Truthfully, I'm very curious about the garment and I want the garment back. Like I want, it sounds like a very special thing that is something that I desire.
You know, when we go through the temple, it makes me wonder if what we're putting on is all just symbolic of something much greater and that in the real eternal realm, I wonder if the robes that we don to show our accomplishments are greater than the body that we possess. In this world state, our bodies are far superior to any garment or symbolic robe that we don. This is how our spirit clothes itself in layers, spirit entering into a physical mortal body. Overcoming that physical mortal body is rewarded with an immortal, spontaneous, rejuvenating, eternal body. Then having done other great things is rewarded with this thing that is beyond my ability to comprehend, which is a robe of light that is even more superior than an eternal, spontaneously rejuvenating, immortal body. It's a reward given to those who overcome and a sign of nobility and royalty. And maybe you, David, have descended from those courts on high, left that light robe behind to try and invite others to come back with you into those realms. Just something to think about. Here's another interpretation of the general meaning of the allegory of the pearl. This is Hugh Nibley. He says, "The pearl is the oldest Christian hymn we have and is certainly the most remarkable."
Hmm.
That's what he thinks.
Interesting.
What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, like I was saying, I think it's the plan of salvation. It's, sorry.
It's okay.
Just ring true.
Yeah. So all the mentioning about independent scholars from different Christian sects is fine and dandy, but I'm not interested in an authoritarian approach to discover the truth of the interpretation of the words in this cryptic ancient manuscript. And the reason for that is I think when we rely on authoritarianism to determine what is right and wrong, that's kind of like what Sherem did in the Book of Mormon when he tried to convince people about the truth by using authority to muster support.
Mm-hmm.
Sherem was an antichrist in the Book of Mormon, and he used his employ of experts to challenge the origins and interpretations of the word, capital W-O-R-D, the word. And he tried to use these expert opinions and knowledge of interpretations as superior evidence and his own understanding to try and persuade people that you can't know that there is a Christ. That's a tactic of the adversary. It's a tactic of Satan to use authoritarianism. Historians who say, hey, I'm the authority on this, therefore believe me, to attack the word. My mechanism for learning what truth is to follow my gut, the light of Christ that is in me. And if the word rings true, then I follow that instinct. It's the words that are important to me, not who wrote them or who interpreted them. And so when I read through this translation, I'm looking for what rings true to me. What is it that seems right to me about this? What is it that seems wrong to me about this? And I'm trying to glean from it the truth. The tool is the knowing that we've talked about before. Do you feel like any of it rings true to you? Does some of it not ring so true to you? What is your truth? What is the truth? We are the Truth Seekers. My name is Mark.
And my name is David.
Until next time, let's bridge the gap.
Truth Seekers.